regions of constructive and destructive interference, sort of the atom de Broglie wave interfering, and so we can use that to measure the atom's phase and use that to make these measurements that I'll tell you about. So this is the slide that I can pretty much skip because we heard all about atom interferometry before, but just to point out that this is the same basic idea that was described very well in the previous talk. As before, we're doing gravimetry, basically. So we have a cloud of atoms shown as this blue ball that we have in free fall. So we drop it in a vacuum tube, for example. And then we use laser pulses shown as these pink arrows, laser pulses along the vertical direction. And those allow us to divide the atom, redirect it, and recombine it. And use that. We can use that to measure, for example, the acceleration of gravity that the atoms feel during the sequence. So you can see a space-time diagram of that here. This is the height of the atom on the vertical axis versus time. And these squiggly lines indicate the three pulses of light that are implementing the atom interferometry. And so you can see the atom comes in these parabolic free fall paths, and the atom gets divided and follows the two paths. There's an upper path and a lower path. And then over here on the right, there's where we recombine the atoms. That's where we would then observe the interference pattern and read out the phase, which tells us about, in this case, the acceleration that the atom felt during the sequence. And so what I want to emphasize in this talk is some of the work we've been doing has been to try to increase the sensitivity of these sensors. And so there's a number of ways to do that, but you can sort of see the basic idea in the figure. What we want to do is make the duration, the time here, as long as possible. We want to open up this area, basically. So we want very long times, long free fall times, and we also want very large vertical separations between the upper and the lower arm. And that's how we can make that area larger, then the sensitivity will increase. And so just to give you an idea or a preview, so if we want to, we can take a picture of the atom at this intermediate time. So at this moment, capital T here, where the atom is in a superposition of the upper and the lower path. So that means the atom is in two places at once, separated vertically. If we try to take a picture, say, of the atom, of course we're talking about localizing the atom. We're collapsing this wave function. But nevertheless, we can do that, and this is an example of what that image looks like. So each atom has a 50% chance of ending up in either the upper or the lower position, and we have about a million atoms, and so we gather statistics on what the wave function looked like at that moment in time. And so you can see where we're going here. This is a 4 centimeter spatial separation between the upper and the lower arm. And so that's one of the ways we can try to get very large sensitivities. So I'll tell you more about that in a moment. But let me begin by discussing one of our original and ongoing science goals for the work here, and that's a test of the equivalence principle. So we heard some discussion of this previously as well, so I won't go too much into detail. We're looking at the historical trends of the equivalence principle for the last 100 years. There's been obviously a lot of improvement in this so-called Etvash parameter, the differential acceleration between the test masses over the mean acceleration, and the current limit on the equivalence principle is set by two experiments sort of in the same range, 10 to the minus 13, and those are shown down here. There's tracking the distance between the Earth and the Moon as they fall around the Sun using lunar laser ranging, and then the experiments with torsion balance at the University of Washington, a series of experiments. I think these actually have the edge, but they're both around the 10 to the minus 13 level. And so when we started off this work, we sort of were aiming for going another two decades. So that's our target, is to ultimately measure, make an equivalence principle test at the 10 to the minus 15 level. And so the system that we want to use for that are our atoms, and we're in particular to start off with talking about two different isotopes of the rubidium atom. So looking at the simultaneous free fall of rubidium 85 and rubidium 87, and looking for small delta A's at the 10 to the minus 15 G level. So that's the idea, and that's motivated, of course, by I think maybe this was mentioned before, just to say again, of course, if you can see a violation, that's a big deal for GR, but also potential new theories of gravity could violate the equivalence principle, as I'll say in a moment. So just to maybe motivate where that 10 to the minus 15 number comes from, it's a target number. If you look at the phase response of the atom interferometer, which we learned before was this KGT squared term, so the sensitivity to accelerations, delta G over G, goes like this. And the phase denominator here, this the signal that we're looking at, is very big. That's where our sensitivity comes from. And so in particular, if you can make T very large, or as I said before, there's a couple ways to make this bigger, but one way is to make T very long. For example, in a 10-meter drop tower, as was introduced, the long free fall time can give you, on the order of seconds, can give you 10 to the 8 radians roughly of phase. And so if you've got that big denominator, then with shot noise statistics on your atoms, so quantum projection noise limited detection of the phase, you can hope to average down to 10 to the minus 15 g after about a month. So that's sort of a, you know, it looks like it could be possible to get there if everything goes great. So I wanted to give one more motivation for testing the equivalence principle in addition to what I said before. One way to talk about it is in terms of searches for fifth forces, new forces that couple to matter in a way that depends on the composition. And so if you think about a Yukawa type interaction, I think we saw some alpha lambda plots before. You can look at the strength of the new force compared to the length scale. And so this is just an example of what such an equivalence principle test with rubidium 85 and rubidium 87 might be able to do on such alpha lambda plot. And of course, this question comes up. You know, if you're going to do the equivalence principle test, you know, you should, in some sense, you want to maximize the violation, right? So you want to choose test masses that have very large charge differences, for example, with respect to this new force. And so, you know, of course, rubidium 85 and rubidium 87 sound very similar. They are very similar, two neutrons difference. But how that comes into testing new physics depends on the physics. And so you can see that if you look at a new force that depends on the number of baryons, for example, this B curve, compare that to another type that might couple to the baryon minus lepton number, you can have large differences. And so certainly there will be some suppressions for some models and less for others. This dashed line, for example, just for reference, are the existing bounds from the torsion pendula data. So you can see there's potentially some regions where we can maybe make some inroads even with this 85-87 test. So that's some of the motivation. So getting into the apparatus level detail. So as I mentioned, we've got a 10-meter tower. So you can see the vacuum system here. We've got a pit in the lab. At the bottom of this apparatus, we have a source of cold atoms. We make Bose-Einstein condensates, and we can launch those atoms vertically upward into this 10-meter fountain region. So the atom source down here, we launch them upwards. We've got a region of magnetically shielded. We've got a magnetic shield here to get Earth's magnetic field down as low as possible. And then we do atom interferometry in this region and do detection at the bottom as the atoms fall back down. You can see the atom source here, and then we have the Coriolis compensation mirror at the bottom. So put 85 and 87 in there and see what you get. So far what we've done is rubidium 87. And so this is our initial results for atom interferometry in the 10-meter tower. So this is the first time we got interference fringes, really using the entire free fall time. So the total duration of the interferometer between the beam splitter and the initial beam splitter and the final beam splitter was 2.3 seconds. And you can see the output ports here. So let me start here. This is a similar picture to the one I showed on the earlier slide. If we take the picture of the atom at the moment of maximum spatial separation, so collapse the wave function, we can see in this particular data set, we had a wave packet separation of 1.4 centimeters. So a little bit smaller than before. This is conventional Raman transition, as was described in the previous talk, a two-photon Raman transition. And what you can see on the left panel here are two pictures showing what the output ports of the interferometer look like. This is the interference pattern that we use to measure phase. So in particular, what you're looking at here is you're counting how many atoms end up in this location as compared to this location here, the lower part of the image. So in this picture, most of the atoms are in the upper port, but in this subsequent picture, most of the atoms are in the lower port. And that's a function of the phase that we're trying to measure. So we just count how many atoms are in these locations. And you can see the ratio plotted versus trial number here, and it's completely all over the place. And that tells me two things. First, the exciting thing is that if you look at the range of this oscillation, it's nearly the full scale that you'd expect for perfect contrast. So this is, I think, actually 80% contrast for this measurement. So there's very good constructive and destructive interference even after this very long time. The reason that there's scatter here and that we don't see a sine wave, for example, is that at this sensitivity, at these very long times, you have a lot of sensitivity acceleration noise, and you're basically measuring the noise of the floor very precisely, which is not an interesting thing. So as I'll describe, and this is a theme of our work, is that always what we'll be doing is measuring, making a differential measurement between two quantities. And so in particular, this is a rubidium 87 interferometer. If you had when we put the rubidium 85 in there, we'll have co-located interferometers, and we'll be able to compare the phases of those two. And this vibrational phase that we're seeing here will be rejected as a common mode. So in terms of sensitivity, from the scatter, we were able to estimate our phase noise and ultimately the acceleration noise at about 7 × 10⁻¹² g per interferometer shot. And so we did a little bit of work averaging that down. After about an hour, we could get down to 5 × 10⁻¹³ g for one isotope. So this is, I think it's about a factor of three away from sort of the back of the envelope estimate that I showed you before. So really in the ballpark of where we want it to be. And so we're excited to then, you know, push this towards hopefully a new test of the equivalence principle in the coming year. But are there ways of making this more sensitive? Like that's, you know, to get down to 10⁻¹⁵, I still need weeks of averaging. And so as I mentioned, not only can we make the time very long, there's also an opportunity to make the separation between the arms larger. And so I wanted took a bit of a sidetrack from pushing on the equivalence principle and have pursued ways of making the scale factor of our sensor larger by increasing the sensitivity using this technique. And so I want to tell you a little bit about these so-called large momentum transfer atom optics. The basic idea is that instead of using a single pulse to separate your atom interferometer, you can come in with a series of additional laser pulses shown as a time series here. And so the first pulse acts as the beam splitter, and the subsequent pulses essentially accelerate away one of the arms with respect to the other to increase the relative velocity between the two arms. And so that gives you a bigger separation, and it turns out you're linearly increasing your sensitivity by adding pulses. I wanted to show you some preliminary results of how that's been working. This is a few months old now, but you can see versus how many additional pulses we add on this axis. So this LMT order 2 corresponds to the sort of conventional interferometry a 2H-bar K Raman transition. With some improvements of our system, we were able to get actually about 98% contrast at the full 2.3 second interferometer duration. As we increase the LMT order, we can continue to see contrast, see constructive and destructive interference out to 12H-bar K, which corresponds to a wave packet separation of 8 centimeters at the apex. And so we believe that's a record for spatial separation of a massive object and showing coherent constructive and destructive interference. You might ask, you know, what's going on here? Why is the contrast going down? Of course, I want to go even higher than this, but right now I can't. And the reason is actually we were actually very happy to see it coming in at this level because it's what you expect for the spontaneous emission rates that we have given our laser parameters. So there's some single photon scattering happening. It's not the Raman transition that you want, and that's a simple function of where we've chosen to operate our laser detunings. And so, as I said, that was expected. And so in the previous couple of months, we've actually been upgrading our laser system to get a factor of 10 in that detuning. And that should allow us to go to about 100 H-bar K, which is kind of an exciting number for us, because at 100 H-bar K, you end up with 1 meter of wave packet separation at the apex of the interferometer. So really an atom in two places at once by a truly macroscopic distance. And so that's, I think, you know, pushing beyond this sort of 10 centimeter number is going to is coming, I think, in the near future. So I wanted to come back to some other applications. So we talked about the equivalence principle. We did some work years ago when we first started getting into studying the EP at this level, and we were asking the question, you know, are there any other novel effects, for example, due to general relativity that this level of sensitivity could see? This is a calculation starting from the Schwarzschild metric near the Earth. In the PPN expansion, you can ask, you know, what new forces due to general relativity does the atom interferometer see that are, you know, beyond the sort of Newtonian gravity that we usually think about for atom interferometry. And so there's a couple different classes of effects that come out of this. If you look at, for example, just to get some intuition, you can look at the acceleration of an atom, dv dt. And so there's a part that comes from Newtonian gravity, of course, grad phi. But then there are some correction terms that you can see here, a number of terms that look like, that scale like the velocity of the atom. These are sort of velocity-dependent force corrections. And also some terms that go like phi squared, sort of nonlinear corrections due to nonlinear in the potential. And so you can sort of, in a hand-wavy way, think about these as in sort of the mnemonic that in general relativity, all types of energy can contribute to gravity. And so this is kind of like the kinetic energy of the atom contributing to acceleration, the gravitational field. And this is the sort of the nonlinear component. So this is due to like the gravitational potential energy of the Earth contributing to the acceleration of the atom fields. And so you can see in a list of, this is sort of a messy list of all the different terms that show up in the interferometer, but sort of low down on the list are these two terms that are due to general relativity, and they're actually at the level where you could measure them in principle, and even in practice, we think that there are techniques for finding these small effects with and extracting them from backgrounds. And so the other thing I wanted to point out here is that, first of all, if you can do that, that's pretty neat because you're testing an aspect of general relativity in a laboratory experiment, and those aren't very common. This is a type of experiment where you could really look for these kind of maybe well-known general relativistic effects in a way where you can tune parameters and maybe even extract some of these PPN parameters. And so this table here shows how that level could potentially be improved as we foresee sensitivity improvements over the years, basically as we increase the wave packet separation using these LMT techniques I told you about. And so they can potentially ultimately compete even with astrophysical experiments. You can imagine at least that happening in the far future. The equivalence principle measurement, we still are aiming for the sort of 10 to the minus 15 level, but I wouldn't say that's a limit. I think in terms of sensitivity at least, we see a path towards increasing that by another couple of decades. We think we understand systematic errors at the so far 10 to the minus 15, maybe 10 to the minus 16 level, but it's exciting to see that if they can be dealt with, if those can be understood even further, the sensitivity could be there for even higher sensitivity. Another big thing we've been thinking about with this sensor is gravitational wave detection. And so I wanted to spend my remaining time telling you about some ideas for how to apply these sensors to that problem. So of course, gravitational waves, I think, are very exciting. I don't think I have to motivate too much here why we want to detect gravitational waves. Certainly, it's a new way to look at the universe. It's a way to see things that are hard to see optically by looking at signals that are generated by the motion of mass rather than the motion of charge. And in addition to sort of interesting astrophysical tests and tests of strong field gravity, there are also gives you a way to understand cosmology as you know, and see things sort of further back in time, if you will, than you can with light. So the way we want to detect gravitational waves is like, for example, like similar to how LIGO works. You have some source, for example, some binary system orbiting around. Those waves propagate, and you have a couple of test masses separated by some baseline. As the wave comes by that baseline, the distance between those test masses will oscillate. And so you want to measure the distance between those two test masses and look for the oscillation. And so our idea is to use atoms rather than using macroscopic mirrors as is done in LIGO, to use an atom at each end of a baseline and use laser light to measure the distance between those two atoms. So this is the sort of cartoon version of what it would look like. You imagine having clouds of atoms separated by some large distance, and you use lasers to implement atom interferometry, and that essentially allows you to measure the light travel time between these two atoms, or really the acceleration in that quantity as a gravitational wave goes by. And so this project we've been collaborating with some folks at NASA for the last few years. We have been developing this work under a grant from the NASA Innovative Advanced Concepts Fund, which has sort of helped support some of the experimental work we've been doing to try to establish some of the important milestones that need to be reached in order for this to become a reality in the future. And so I want to tell you about some of that, I guess, in terms of motivation. You know, why is this worth thinking about before we get into the details? You can see this is a strain sensitivity curve. This is the potential strain H of a gravitational wave that you could see with the sensor versus frequency. And so you can see this red curve is the atom response curve that we think we can get. In comparison, you can see at higher frequencies, LIGO and advanced LIGO come in out here. You can see the proposed LISA antenna is sort of in this range. And so in this exercise, we sort of were going through and looking at what sort of numbers would we need to look for this sort of scientifically interesting frequency range with an atom sensor. And so one of the things to point out about this is, and I'll get to this a little more at the end, as I showed in the previous slide, this is a one-dimensional sensor. You've got two clouds of atoms separated by a linear baseline. And of course, the LISA antenna uses three satellites. And the fundamental reason for that, that we can avoid that, that we can get away with two spacecraft, is the common mode suppression that we can get on the laser frequency noise by comparing those two clouds of atoms. And that allows us to avoid needing three spacecraft. So we think that that's an exciting reason to pursue this by itself, just as a way to maybe reduce complexity or possibly cost in such a design. The other thing to point out is that at this same strain sensitivity, the baseline that we're talking about is more than 1,000 times shorter than the LISA antenna. And that in part comes from the ability to do these large momentum transfer, essentially phase enhancement techniques. So this idea doesn't have to be done in space. You can see this blue curve here is an estimate of where we think even a ground-based sensor could potentially come. For technical reasons, it's hard to go below a fraction of a hertz. But in this sort of region where LIGO isn't working so well, you could potentially, even with a ground-based sensor, see some maybe some interesting signals. So there's also, as I mentioned, cosmological motivation for gravitational wave detection. This shows the omega GW, the power in gravitational waves as a function of frequency. This red curve shows what our sensor could potentially see in comparison to a number of models of sources of these sort of stochastic gravitational waves. You can see these oranges, a network of cosmic strings. I think this curve from inflation maybe is a little bit different now, depending on how the BICEP 2 results come in. But I think that it's not too far off. And so certainly, you know, one way to look at it is that this is, if you could use such a sensor to see inflation-based a source of stochastic gravitational noise, it would be extremely exciting, because we're essentially 18 orders of magnitude higher in frequency than the results that you'd get from a CMB type.
And what is RSI?
This is a phase transition in the early universe, I guess. If you're interested, my theory collaborators, RS1, not I, RS1, sorry, yeah. So this is some, you know, I think to do this, you of course need to do correlation among multiple sensors. So exciting physics that could be potentially seen. So as I mentioned, there's a number of technical things that have to happen for this to work, and I don't have time to go into all the work we're doing on this, but I wanted to give a couple of touchstones on some recent results that we've been doing to make this sort of sensor a reality. One of the things that has to happen is we need these sensors to operate for long times. I showed 2 seconds of atom interferometry. We need to go beyond 10 seconds. And so for that, you need to be really cold. So with our Bose-Einstein condensed sources right now, we're below the microkelvin range. We're in the sort of the couple of nanokelvin range already. But we need to be in the picokelvin range. And so how do you do that? And so this is a well-known idea that's been around for many years, essentially the analog of a lens for atoms. So of course, if you have a diverging beam of light, you can put a piece of glass and collimate that beam. What we mean by temperature of atoms is the effective temperature is just the RMS velocity of the cloud. So if you have an expanding cloud of atoms, you can apply a position-dependent force to the atoms to effectively collimate that atom beam. So we want to do atom lensing. And it turns out the temperature reduction ratio goes like the ratio of the size of the atom squared the expansion ratio during this lens process. So we set out to do sort of a proof of concept experiment. Can you cool down into the sub nanokelvin range with such a scheme? And so we launch our atoms upward. As they're launched, they're expanding because of their temperature. And so what we do is we apply a potential from an optical beam. There's a vertically propagating beam. It exerts a Stark shift. It depends on radial position. And so it acts like near the center of the beam are harmonic potential. And so what that does is that it actually can use to collimate or even refocus the atom cloud. And so you can see dramatically here, this is what the atom cloud looks like if we don't do anything. When we apply the focusing lens, we can actually shrink that atom cloud dramatically down by applying this force.
And
in two dimensions. So it's, the beam is vertically propagating, so in the X and Y direction you get collimation. So in the vertical direction, it's still at the same 3 nanokelvin temperature. And so this is sort of a proof of concept that, and the motivation for doing this is, so as I mentioned, this is an old idea, and it's been speculated that if you're in a micro-G environment, like if you're in a satellite, you would have a second to do expansion. You could get a very large expansion ratio here in that way. And what we realize is that in our tall tower, we have more than a second of freefall time where we can allow the very large expansion ratio and get to these cold temperatures. And so that's the motivation why we can do what other people hadn't been able to do, to this level at least. And so this shows the size of the atom cloud versus how long we apply this focusing procedure. You know, so in other words, we can refocus the atoms, as I showed before. We can also collimate the atoms. And so at the collimation point, we were able to infer a temperature of 50 picokelvin, effective temperature, based on the expansion. So we believe that's in sort of a new level of cooling that we're able to show. And that's sort of the level you need for getting to the level that you need for these long-time gravitational wave detectors. So it's a proof of concept for cooling, but it also has other applications. Even though we don't cool in the vertical direction, it turns out being cold radially is useful because it allows us to do this sort of relaunch process. So we can shrink the atom cloud back down, and when it's small again, it fits once again in our acceleration lattice that we use to launch the atoms. And so we're able to use this technique to relaunch the atom cloud. And so it's essentially a way to increase the effective amount of freefall time that the atom experiences. You get a sort of two bounces here. And so this is a picture of an atom cloud that was launched to over 9 meters. We refocused it, recaught it, relaunched it to 6 meters. And so we haven't done it yet, but we think that this would allow you to try out at least interferometry beyond 10 seconds. So that's one of the things we'll need for long-time gravitational wave detection. Just wanted to quickly show this too. Another issue that you have to worry about is if you're looking, you know, these two satellites separated by a long distance, you worry about the pointing jitter of your laser. That's a big systematic. But well, we developed a technique for measuring in situ that pointing jitter. And so what we've done here is essentially we've got our three laser pulses, pulse, pulse, pulse. If we change the angle of one of those laser pulses, we impart a position-dependent phase, k dot x, across the atom cloud. And you can see the output port 1, the output port 2 has this spatial corrugation on it, these fringe patterns. And that's a result of this misaligned final pulse. And it turns out by looking at the periodicity of that, we can learn something about what that angle is. And so you could use that as a way to in situ measure the angle or maybe even the wavefront of the laser beams, which is another important systematic. It also lets you see the instantaneous phase of the interferometer on each shot just by watching this pattern evolve, which, as I mentioned, this sort of stochastic pattern that we currently see due to the vibration noise, we're able to measure that on a single shot. My last topic is laser phase noise. This was something that came up in the previous talk, the idea to use strontium. And so I wanted to maybe give a little bit more detail of how that would work. As I mentioned, one of the big motivations we have is single baseline detection. And so the reason that can work is you're fundamentally limited by the noise of your laser. You're trying to measure the distance between these atoms, but if your laser is a noisy thing, you have to find a way of suppressing that. And so we have a scheme to do that, and the basic idea is you've got your, so this is a space-time diagram now of this gravitational wave sensor. So we've got time on the vertical axis and the baseline separation horizontally. So there's one atom here, and on the other end of the baseline is the other atom. And so, as I mentioned, we're doing atom interferometry on each end of the baseline. And the point is that these squiggly lines, which represent the laser pulses, you can see if that laser pulse travels across the baseline, if this laser is a noisy thing, any noise on that laser, once that light leaves the laser, it's going to be the same. So it's going to be written onto this atom, and it's not going to change when it propagates across the baseline. And it'll be imprinted equivalently on the second atom. So that's what lets us then, when we ultimately compare the two phases, suppress that noise. And it turns out for technical reasons that only works because of the ability to use a single photon transition in strontium or other alkali earth-like systems. So if you've got a real two-level atom, rather than the Raman transition that we were using with rubidium, which uses counterpropagating beams, the ability to use a single photon transition with light from one direction allows you to make this cancellation extremely well. And so this scheme also allows for large momentum transfer atom optics. This is an example of how that would look. Basically, you send laser excitation from one side, wait a little bit, then send another excitation from the other side. And so the first excitation puts the atom into the excited state, shown in red, and then you can bring the atom back down in the ground state coming from the other direction in blue, and you can repeat that over and over again. And so you can see why this scheme actually, why this helps, because the atom's phase, the atom evolves phase while it's in this excited state. Its phase evolves a little bit faster, and it turns out, if you can see that almost from the diagram, that the amount of time the atom sends in this excited state depends on the light travel time back and forth across the baseline. And so that's fundamentally how this sensor would detect gravitational waves. The amount of phase you accumulate here would depend on the light travel time, and that's what's being varied if a gravitational wave goes by. So it's a great idea, we think. We have to try it out experimentally. And so sort of the next big thing that we're going to be working on is setting up a demo experiment looking at a gradiometer between two strontium atoms, sharing a common laser, and trying out this excitation scheme and see if this laser noise does really suppress at the level we think. Because if it works, which we don't see any reason why it shouldn't, then that could be a really exciting way to pursue a gravitational wave detector. Of course, we're also going to continue the work in the 10-meter tower, pushing for larger wave packet separation. I think I mentioned a meter, but we've got a 10-meter vacuum tube, so we could even imagine ways of ultimately, filling the entire tower with an atom at each end of it, bringing it back together. And I think that would be, obviously an extremely exciting quantum mechanical state. I didn't mention it, but, just by seeing an atom separated by, in this case, 8 centimeters, bringing it back together and seeing interference, we've showed that quantum mechanics sort of works the way we all expect at that level. And as I said, I think that's a new regime for massive objects, it looks like so far. Everything is behaving as expected. I should also mention there's some work going on with some collaborators in France. This is work by Philippe Boyer setting up a so-called MIGA project, which is an atom interferometric gravitational wave detector concept using some kilometer tunnels that they have there. So there's some work around the world. We think people are getting excited about this idea, and hopefully that we can make some inroads. So I just wanted to acknowledge all the many collaborators that are part of this work, and that's all for me. So.
Hey, can you show your noise curves again? So my question was, why is it that the binaries go up and down?
Yeah, that's just because of the integration time. So the detectability essentially goes up for the lower frequencies because you can average for longer. But then at some point, I think it's cut off at a year, maybe, essentially. So at longer times, we're not being able to average as long. So it's not as sensitive.
How good is your sky localization?
Say again?
Have you estimated how good the sky localization would be?
Sky localization. We haven't really thought much about that. I guess with a single baseline, you're relying on the reorientation of the baseline to get information about that. And so it would depend on the orbit. And that's certainly something we haven't committed to.
Maybe this is a question for the audience. But is there some sort of physics that would give rise to transient or periodic equivalence principle violations? Is that something? And I don't know. I mean, is there something that an experiment that's measured equivalence principle over a time?
Not that I'm aware of. I'm not aware of an experiment, but I'm not sure about the theory.
There is an effect in gravitational waves. Similar to these operators that we're writing before that will have effects on atomic clocks. Mm. We'll have also forces on atoms or on the meters of Lisa and LIGO.
And differential forces.
Yes, differential forces. There you turns out you get suppressed by gradients because you can think about it like we're talking about dark matter oscillating, for example, or in your case it would be a transient. But then the signal, because the baseline is short, you get suppressed by gradients. So because the force is common, so you get suppressed by the momentum. So there is some sensitivity of these gravitational wave detectors. Of course, you're always sensitive to the frequency that the gravitational wave detector is sensitive to, but it's not as, in principle, it's not that much sensitive. I mean, age is maybe a bit more sensitive than current equivalence principle tests at those scales, but it's tough because of the gradient suspension. It's like the force is common between the two, and then you have to worry about gradients. So that gives you the additional suppression.
So
I guess the triangle shapes, say Lisa, that triangle shape makes it specifically sensitive to polarization two modes, right? And you, I guess, presumably you aren't, right? So you would also be sensitive if there happened to be like 10 to the minus 2 hertz electromagnetic signals. Would you also be sensitive to those?
So as a background, potentially.
Or as a, well.
Yeah, I mean, we have to worry about. So if
I mean, there could be interesting signals there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess. First thing I think about, I worry about you know, electromagnetic signals being a background, and so there, you know, we have to worry about magnetic couplings to the atoms that we understand. But I guess, I mean, I haven't thought about.
But yeah,
so
you're sensitive
are there
to
backgrounds?
Scalar force for sure.
Yeah. So you're definitely sensitive to scalars. How about vectors?
Yeah, no, exactly. Anything that it's just a single baseline. So exactly, you don't have to have the tensor bolt.
Is there magnetic shielding on the detectors, or are there electromagnetic backgrounds at those frequencies?
Yeah. So we think we can operate we operate a magnetic shield right now on Earth. So we think in a satellite type situation, the magnetic shielding requirements are reduced, so you don't need. So we aren't planning on that, but.
And you operate in magnetically insensitive state.
Sure. Yeah. So it's right. So we're in an n equals zero state, so it's a second order type. But yeah. So that's. I mean, I should also say in terms of polarization. So you know, the fact that the baseline will reorient does give you some polarization information, at least on longer time scales. So it's not completely insensitive to polarization.
So, Valerio, could you please start preparing? We will continue.
No.
Yeah. A question on that. So in order to implement this kick or refocusing that you're doing in the interferometer, you have to have a similar light shift on both arms of the interferometer. Do you have a sense to the degree that you'll be able to make that the same?
That's a great question. I think for the shorter separations at the centimeter level, I think we think that would work because it's a collimated beam. The alignment's pretty important, so it's something to work on. We haven't done it, but I think we have ideas where you could even focus one arm at a time, and then sort of because the focusing only really works in a certain even if the beam is collimated, if it's slightly diverging, it's really sensitive to that, it turns out. So you could imagine focusing, if the separation is big enough, you could focus one arm and then focus the other one at a later time. So it's since it's pulsed, we can sort of apply it when we want, as long as the other arm isn't too much affected.